It's Monday, August 7th, 2006, and you're listening to episode 13 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 54 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot, and this is our 13th episode, and
It's already been going great.
Yeah, episode 13 indeed. I cannot tell you guys how many problems we have had off the podcast, trying to get things set up here to run it. The dog's going crazy, and this, that, and the other. So anyway, we're going to try and pull this together and still get a good episode out of this. I want you guys to know that the forces of nature and the heavens above are definitely not in favor of this podcast working out. So let's see how we go here. All right, I'm Dan, and I have with me today Chad.
Hi.
And also Dawn.
Hi.
We've been saying for a while that with John headed off to Rome, and I think he's actually coming back for one or two more episodes before he finally leaves at the end of the month.
So, yeah.
But we said with John headed off to Rome that we were going to replace John with Dawn. And Adam was not able to make this one either, so Dawn's actually right now filling in two seats. Mm-hmm. And since she's pregnant, she actually did, by sitting there, bring two people.
Yeah.
So talented.
She actually did kind of help out there. So for those of you that were wanting a woman's perspective on gaming, we still don't think it's really all that different than a guy's perspective. But nonetheless,
I really don't either, but hey, I don't mind doing this for you guys.
I think you can generalize a little less combat. A little more story.
Yeah.
Maybe. Well, but you know what? I'm a guy and I want less combat.
A lot
more
dragons, a lot more vowels in the character names, things like that. But that's really.
Vowels? This all has to do with vowels?
Yes. And ampersands and tildes.
Apostrophes, yeah, and all this great punctuation you get in all of
the
names.
Know. I think it's pretty gender neutral with the vowels.
Now, before we got on here, we were talking about age and gaming.
Yes.
And before we go into kind of a...
Because none of the youngins are here today.
Right, right. It's nothing but us old folks, so we can kind of tear into them. But before we get into that, we had a non-gaming-related age story we wanted to throw out since the youngins aren't here.
Yeah.
So, Chad, I want you to tell me about you and Adam at the movie theater.
Well, you have to remember that when Adam and I first met, I was, what, 22? Maybe 23.
No, you were older than that.
Maybe 25.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there.
You had been around 25.
And anyway,
mid-20s.
He was like 15. Now, I'm sure Adam, who's really good with math and numbers and stuff, is going to come back and he's going to be like, this was your age. This was the date. This was my age. I'm not good with that sort of thing. Anyway, so I was about 25-ish. He was about 15 or 16, I think. No, he had to be 16 because he was driving. We became friends, even though there was like 10 years, an entire decade separating our ages. Well, he wanted to get into a rated R movie. And in Missouri, at least, you have to be 18. And I think there was some...
I was 17, but... Point being, you can't be 12
you can't be
or whatever
50,
he was at
yeah.
the time.
I can't believe they actually asked for his ID.
Yeah, they carded him. They asked for his ID, and he couldn't get into this movie. For the life of me, do not remember what the movie is. But, he asked me, it's like, hey, man, could you buy my ticket for me? I can't get it. And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll buy your ticket. And so I bought his ticket. Because the problem was that he was, like, 15, but he looked like he was 12.
Now, he was saying something like, or you guys were talking about this, and one, he was cracking jokes about you posing as his dad.
Yeah.
Did that actually happen?
Yes.
You really did pose as his dad.
Yeah. There were multiple people who thought I was his father. Because...
Now, mind you, the age difference here is like, what, 7 or 8 years?
Yeah, 10 years at the most.
Yeah,
But like I said, you have to remember, he was 16 years old. He looked like he was 12. I was 25. I looked like I was 30. I always look like I'm older than I am. People just assumed that I was taking my son to see this rated R movie. And there were people in restaurants and stuff. There were probably about two or three people who thought that he was my father, he was my son, and I was his father.
That's a beautiful thing.
It is.
That's a beautiful thing.
It is. And I'm sure that he's just like right now going,
just like a Murloc.
Yes, yes.
All right, now what we were talking about more gaming related with age, we were talking about how gaming has changed in all the years that we have played.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast is really in one of a couple positions. You are either right about our age or older, so you're kind of on the more age-wise mature side of gaming.
Yeah.
We don't know about actually like emotionally mature. We don't know you personally. Maybe you're a geezer.
I don't know. People on our boards range everywhere from 15 to 50.
Right.
So.
And we sure got people on the other end who are listening to us who are fairly young gamers and may not even realize yet the amount of growth their gaming habits has yet to go through.
Yeah, they think they're at the pinnacle. Just like we thought that we were at the pinnacle when we were 15.
We thought we had master games going on today. Yeah. We look back and laugh at the things we did.
Embarrassment.
I know. So let's talk about kind of where we've come from gaming. So when we started, it was 1988. And at the time, I guess...
Star Trek, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we were pretty freaking young at the time, like junior high-ish or something like that. Star Trek's game by FASA was, we've said many times, was the first game that we played as a group.
It's a great game, too. The FASA one is great.
Let's talk about some of the things we did wrong, largely because of age and role-playing and experience.
The characters didn't have personalities. They had roles.
Yeah, very true.
I was a security officer. I was a navigator. And I picked a stereotype and I played the stereotype. I remember you were a security officer with one and you had this thing with these guns. You could roll out this sheet and it had all these pieces of guns and you could put together any kind of gun you wanted out of it. And really, that was it. That was your character.
That was the character.
It was really cool, though.
Yeah, and that's big time. Is at the time, it was really...
It's cool factor.
Yeah, it's cool factor. So what was cool? What was powerful? It was not what was deep or what was sensible. Mm-hmm. I remember I would sit there just dorking around outside of the game, saying, man, I can't wait for that game. And I'd start drawing up little, like, game aids, things that we could use during the game. Like, I'd drop a brochure for, like, a cybernetics lab that was selling cybernetics to people. Of course, all combat-oriented.
Right, you know, right.
Gun arms and super strength.
Gun arms.
All kinds of ridiculous stuff like that. It was all about...
I can get 4 cybernetic arms, and each arm has a gun. That's 4 guns.
Yeah, exactly. All these kind of silly little concepts. Very concept-driven, too, actually, now that I say that. Concept. You could typically sum up most characters in one sentence.
Mm-hmm. You know, or one word or sometimes.
A fragment. He's the guy with the cybernetic arms.
Yeah.
He's the guy who knows all about guns.
Big robot.
Yeah, he's
gun
a big
guy.
Robot.
But you know what? Were our games really that combat-oriented? I know a lot of, like, younger people, it tends to just be, like we said, the string of monsters going off into the void that you take on one by one by one.
No, they really weren't. You know, I think back to it, even though we had these very simplistic concepts that typically went down to some kind of attribute of power combat, they really weren't combat-oriented.
Yeah.
I had the number of fights then I probably do today, which is 0-2 a game.
And you know what? I'm not saying that we had these really deep plots in the place of combat where others didn't. We didn't have plots. We had missions.
Puzzles.
We didn't even have missions. We had goals with puzzles in between.
Goals with obstacles. Very linear.
Yeah.
Very linear.
But I remember John telling me a story of his early gaming groups and stuff where it would be this dungeon. No reason why the dungeon's there. No reason why the players were there except they were adventurers and that's what adventurers did.
Right.
And then they would walk into a room and there'd be a fight and then there'd be another room. And then the games developed. There would be 2 rooms. Do you go left or do you go right? And then they would develop beyond that. There's a closed door now. Oh, my God. What do we do about this door?
I always love these little dungeons that are there for no particular reason. It's like there's this dungeon with all these treasures. And maybe there's a story behind it like, oh, the dead king left this behind. Well, why has no one gone here and gotten the treasure before? Oh, people have and none have come back. Okay, we're level 5. We're going to... The level 15 people didn't come back, but we're going to go take this place. And
Or I love the ones where it's like the evil Lick runs his evil empire on the other side of 15 layers of death traps and monsters and wandering beasts.
Yeah, how does this guy get home at night?
Yeah, how does he get to work?
He's got to have another way to get out. It's like he's like jumping and throwing himself across the room to get through.
I
all
can't
these
imagine
freaking traps.
The evil Lick in all the flowing robes and he's half dead and he's like saying all these cool lines as he's lifting up his robes to slowly tiptoe over that tripwire that releases the slimes on him or something like that.
Pulling the poison darts out of his girlfriend and apologizing profusely. Now, Don, what about you? Because we started, I don't know why I remember the year, it was 1988. Yeah. And we did not meet you until 1994.
Yeah. So people in your numbers.
We're talking like 6 years later.
I never remember.
And you had been
stuff.
Gaming before we met you. What was your first game?
Well, it was Star Wars. And
this would have been
honestly,
West End, right?
Yeah, the West End Star Wars, and honestly, I don't remember a single thing from the game. It was very chaotic. We had a lot of players. It was
tons of players.
It was taking place in a gaming shop. I really knew next to nothing about the hobby when I started, so...
And you don't remember anything about what the game was like?
I remember there being a lot of six-siders being rolled. I don't even remember what my first character was. It's probably somewhere in my archives.
All right, well, I'm going to have to fill in some details. If you don't remember, I'm going to have
I don't think that I was involved in this game.
When I first started gaming with your other gaming group at the time, and before we kind of merged and became one group, which, for those of you keeping score, this is completely separate from the gaming group, the Chatnow Games group, and the gaming group that I have historically gamed with. This is a third group. So when I came into them, the character you were playing at the time, this was in an in-house created game. Where you could play anything. It was a neat, that's what I liked about it, just like with Rifts, except the rules were a little better balanced. And you were playing a little tiny dragon.
Named Emil. Okay, well, yeah, I remember that. But I don't think that was for Star Wars, though. That was for a different game.
That was not. But I wasn't there for your first Star Wars game.
No, we didn't game at the comic book
shop. Some of my earlier characters were kind of lame. But I put a lot of heart into Emil, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, at the time, Emil was very annoying. In retrospect, Emil was very funny.
It was what I was capable of at the time as far as a character, you know? Like, I was basically using her as my sock puppet.
Sock puppet.
It's like, I can just imagine it. You know, you have what your mind's eye sees while you're playing the game, and all the other players see this dragon that's about 4 feet in length and claws and scale and does these silly things. And then you sit there and you see yourself amongst all these big guys with guns, and you're just sitting there in your blue jeans and t-shirt, and you have a little sock puppet. A little, you go, bah, 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 bah.
Green sock with button eyes and a little jagged comb going down the top and a thumb for a mouth.
I only used like this squeaky voice when I talked with her. And she also later became a flirting device.
Oh, yeah.
We won't get into that.
No. That goes into either fear of the dating or fear of the drama. One of the two.
Yeah, I know. So. Oh,
the good old days.
The good old days.
All right, so from there, from our early days, we moved into what I consider, at least up to this point, our middle ages of gaming. Mm-hmm. And this really came about when there was kind of a coming together of two groups. Mm-hmm. The group that Chad and I had at that point been historically gaming with.
Which, again, not much in the way of story.
Right, no story, but a lot of realism, a lot of grit, a lot of... I guess realism and grit, I'm sorry, without a thesaurus, that's as deep as I'm getting. But we went and started gaming with what was Dawn's group at the time, which had very little realism, very little balance, but had a lot of, their characters were a little more thought out, a lot of story, a lot of colorful settings, they weren't so objective-based. As we went through, what were those games like? I remember there was a lot of cultural clash because we were demanding grit and they were demanding depth. And there was a lot of...
I remember, well, for me, because I brought you in on it later, for me it was such change of pace.
You know, visiting different planets and taking over starships and, and putting your boots on the general's desk and things like that.
Yeah.
Just crazy
stuff.
And
in our games, it's like if somebody pulled a gun... Well, we would never die, but they would. It was kind of like the difference between fantasy, like high fantasy, and then real hard sci-fi, and then having those two meet.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. It was a real culture shock, and I think being as young as we all were, it was something that we all tried to rebel against. They tried to rebel against us. We tried to rebel against them. Yet we were all friends and we were all still getting along. When in reality, we were all really learning and coming to this middle ground of what a better game would be. You know, they would cool it off a little bit and we would kind of bring ours up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And and out of that, we learned that, wow, you can actually have characters that have a personality and aren't a walking gun. Mm-hmm. And then you can... And then they learn that it's like, wow, you don't have to have a dragon tail sword and jump 15 feet in the air to have fun.
Yeah, and if you put your boots on the desk of the general, his guards will kick your ass.
Yeah. That was a big one we had to get around.
And yeah. if you're this giant 18-foot-tall cyborg, you can't fit every place.
That was always fun.
There's drawbacks to that.
Yes.
Now, I won't talk too much about where we are today, because quite frankly, that's what this podcast is about, is where we are today. But one of the concerns I have about where we game today, because we have with us now, after all these years of doing this, a lot of depth that we took, of course, mm-hmm. from Dawn's group, and we have a lot of realism that we have taken from our group.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever worry that we take gaming too seriously? Let me explain that.
That we're gaming snobs? Hell yeah, we are.
I don't mean gaming. I don't mean gaming too seriously, as in like we're psycho. Okay, mm-hmm. I don't mean like we can't.
Like it's real.
Yeah, I don't mean like that. What I mean is that we have hit the point where gaming is such a refined science that we're almost in the danger of ceasing to have fun.
Oh no, I wouldn't say that we're ceasing to have fun. I think that. Well, let me put to you in the example of this podcast, like why we do this podcast. Because when we're not at this podcast, we sit around and we talk about gaming.
Right.
Like the ins and outs and the mechanics of gaming and how to make better games. We really get off on talking about this. The only thing we're doing with this podcast is hitting
on
record.
The mics. Yeah, yeah, we've been doing this for years. Yeah. So.
No, I think that we're gaming snobs. I think that like we expect a certain level of game and a certain level of character and
right.
plot and realism and a certain element of fantasy and to go beyond.
Right.
Yeah.
I worry sometimes.
I don't worry about it. I embrace it.
I think some of us are bigger snobs than others.
Because like, okay, I don't know. I mean, now that I'm running a game for you guys, like with the other group of people I run games for, I worry sometimes that we have our goals so high in terms of the depth and realism we want out of the characters, the detail and the subplots we want out of the campaign and the setting. I mean, we enjoy it. We enjoy right. the end product, but we have put so much work into it and have such huge expectations for it that we have lost sight of the simple fun we used to have sitting around back during those early and middle right. ages of our gaming. It's hard for me because I can definitely say, yeah, we have lost some of that simple fun, but if you put me back in that setting right now, I'd hate it.
Oh, I hate it, yeah.
Because it's not what I enjoy anymore.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's like we tell Phil all the time, too, when we were gaming with him. Phil's a power gamer, and we're not power gamers. And we would debate with him back and forth, and then the arguments would get a little heated. And then in the end, we had to say, well, listen, Phil, you're a power gamer. Do you enjoy power gaming? Yes, I do. Is the purpose of a role-playing game to have fun? Yes. Then go for it. You are achieving the goal of a role-playing game. And we can only say that we don't like it. We cannot possibly say that you are wrong.
I was thinking a little bit about that grit versus flair thing mm-hmm. that we had going on when those two groups came together. And it just kind of made me think about how everyone that runs or plays in these games, of course, brings with them their experiences. That you say, well, I think a person whose parents were killed by orcs would act this way because of people you've observed who've lost their parents, mm-hmm. or maybe even things you've gone through in your own life, or even fictional things. I read this book about this little mm-hmm. girl whose parents were killed by orcs, and whether you intend to or not, that colors how you
right.
do it. And one of the things I was thinking about is the fact that the GM of that other group was very big into movies.
Mm-hmm.
And when he GM'd, he would even give cut scenes
right.
in the movie. And, like, you know, he would tell us, he would act out scenes of, like, mm-hmm. this is the evil general meeting with the other evil general, yeah. and this is the things they're talking about.
I actually emulate that style in my gaming.
And out of that
like
came
it.
A very almost hands-off storyteller flair,
mm-hmm.
where at times, sometimes that which is plot important or that which is cool replaces that which is believable. Whereas my background came more from heady literature.
Simulationist.
Yeah, simulationist, heady literature. I'm more into books and prose.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was more about the point of view and the grit and the careful descriptions and things like that. And of course, both styles had their weaknesses, but they were the ultimate result of the experiences
right.
and the things we had been through.
Well, to me, it has to be fun. If it's if it's realistic and not fun, then there's no point in it. But to me, you have to have a certain grounded realism to be fun. I remember an argument you always made, Dan. It's like, if you start throwing all the realism out, then the players can just start making things up. It's like, okay, the guys are coming after me. You know, it's just like, we're not obeying the laws of physics and we're not doing this and that. And then it's like, well, why can't I just say, I just leap up into the air and fly away?
Yeah, just flap my arms and fly away. We've thrown every other rule of law of physics out the window. We have thrown every other sense of continuity. So why can't I just flap my arms and fly away?
Yeah.
You know, and it's...
But, and to me, I always liked our friend's explanation of this, of why you just can't flap your wings and fly away. You take the framework of the fantasy, and you have that outrageousness be consistent. You know, it's like you can have this total ludicrousness of people doing Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon type stuff, leaping from, you know, rooftop to rooftop to rooftop. You never see them leap up into the air and then land 100 miles away, even though they can leap 100 feet
away.
See,
that's kind of what I'm talking about, is that those experiences you bring with it, that there's this framework, this sort of creative or literary framework of the sorts of movies or things he was into that he was bringing to the table. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't want to focus too far, because we have on the big board, where do you draw good limits of suspension of disbelief?
Yeah.
Or as I like to put it, where is the line between the suspension of disbelief and the expulsion of disbelief?
I think that's like almost a whole podcast, and that would not even be advice. That's like a philosophical discussion.
That's going to be a soapbox rant. But I guess for me, I need some kind of a realism, because otherwise it's hard to know. I'm a very resourceful gamer. Mm-hmm. You know, I will use unusual things to get unexpected results. And if I don't know what the limits are, it's not a rules lawyer thing, but it's just like, if I don't know what the limits of the reality are, you know, when you live in a world where swords do like 3 times as much damage as guns, which makes no sense whatsoever. Let's talk about RPG novels. Actually, as we're sitting here talking about, because we're talking about literary genres and how they affect storytelling. Let's go the other direction. Talk about RPG novels.
I've only read a handful myself.
Yeah,
I'm not a
big
fan.
All right, let's start on the positive. What are some of the good ones you've read and why? Dawn, what are some good RPG novels you've read and why are they good?
Well, let's see. I read like the first 3 Dragonlance novels, and I really liked them when I first read them. And then, like, you know, 5 years later, I tried to read them again, and I didn't like them. So that's not really very positive.
Well,
but
what changed? How that?
Basically, what changed was, I became more mature in the stuff I was reading when I was older, was more mature.
Isn't that sad, though, since they were probably written by an adult to begin with?
Yeah.
I find that, you know, you can grow out of books.
Yeah.
You really can.
Yeah.
And that just happened to be something I grew out of. But I did read, like, a couple of BattleTech novels that I really enjoyed. Stories were interesting.
Which one? Give me one.
It was something to do with the Kuritas. I can't remember the title, though.
Quite
a few of those books.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
I think was it the Clan Invasion one?
It wasn't Michael the Clan Stackpole Invasion wrote? One. It was something to do with one of the clan, the leaders of the Kurita.
I know what she's talking. I know. Yeah. All right, Chad, bad ones you've read.
Oh.
Just give me one or two.
Bad ones I've read are the, also one of the good ones I've read too, is the Stackpole ones that we just talked about.
Okay, why were some of those good?
Well,
come back to
the Stackpole ones were, what are they called? The Clan Invasion ones. They have a name.
Right. They're talking about the Blood of Kerensky trilogy.
Blood of Kerensky trilogy, yeah. Interesting book. Uh-huh. He got into the characters. I really, really liked the characters and, you know, got into the story and stuff. And so they were really good in that way. And I did not get the sense that this
positive
was...
Positive only. Positive.
Positive. That this isn't this guy's gaming group.
I've got that as a bullet point. We're going to come back to, so go
That's
on.
My problem with some of the D&D books. This guy, it isn't his gaming group that he just transcribed in one of his campaigns. But yeah, I really got into it, and all the characters were different and lively and stuff. He's a good author. I do have problems with it, though, too, because on the other hand...
Oh, we'll come back to that.
Oh, okay.
Good only. All right, good books I've read, gaming books. Now, I'm going to admit up front that for the most part, the only gaming books I have read is I've read a whole bunch of BattleTech books, and I have read like one Shadowrun book, one or two. That's really about it. All the big D&D books, R.A. Salvatore and all that, sorry, just haven't read them.
I've read a couple of the D&D books on Kinder. I think there's one on the Kinder and the Dwarfs that Kevin recommended to me, and those were pretty good. They were swashbuckling adventures.
Do you know what the names were? Who wrote
them?
Oh
my God, there's so many. So many, and it was so long ago, I can't possibly
remember. They do churn those D&D novels out. BattleTech books came out.
I think it also has to do with just what the audience that they're aimed at, which is, you know, mid-teen boys for the most part. The stuff that was written was not geared to, you know, like a 20, 25-year-old girl.
Right.
Or woman or whatever. I just could not get in. On the other hand, you know, I did have a large collection of Mercedes Lackey books. So, and all the, you know, all the covers are purple. He was like, think about it.
Very sweet looking unicorns on them.
Look, they don't have unicorns on them.
The best gaming book I've probably ever read was Jim Long's Main Event.
Yes, I love
it. It's a Battletech book that does not center on huge politics. It's just kind of a pseudo character study about a very small number of people that get together, a very minor mercenary corps, and just go out and take on some
clanners.
Some clanners. And one of the things I liked about it, outside of the fact that I'm a huge pro-Intersphere anti-clan guy, but one of the other things I liked about it was the fact that I thought not only was the writing good and the characters interesting, but also he had a respect for Battletech as a whole.
Right.
That the things he wrote, you could have very conceivably seen happening on a map combat.
Mm-hmm. He had played the game before.
He killed off some of his characters, but it wasn't senseless. It was very random. It's like a guy jumps up and hops on a building to look around. And
they blast him.
They take his head off.
Yeah.
And it's just... Mm-hmm. Now, let me bridge this from the good into the bad.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about Stackpole, because you brought him up.
Right.
What I liked about Stackpole is I thought overall he's a very good writer.
Yeah.
Great prose writer, wonderful characters. I loved his characters. My primary beef with Stackpole and why I would not consider his work to be in my top of Battletech stuff, or from what I've read of his stuff, really not top of most of my stuff, is he has absolutely no respect for the technical aspects and the aspects of feel of what he is writing.
That you can tell that he isn't a Battletech player.
Oh, he admits that on his own website. Yeah. I mean, he admitted he's played like two combats ever of Battletech. And he just had things going on in his books that did not make any sense to the mechanics of the universe, and also didn't make any sense really to the feel of the universe.
Right.
That he had great big heroes that were invincible and things like that. And it just...
The characters were the best of the best of the best and then beyond.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay. You know, I don't play those guys. So that's why I liked Main Event so much. And I think that Main Event was such a much better book than the entire Blood of Kerensky series. It's because I play, when I play Battletech, individuals who do not have an impact on the huge overall politics of the universe. Mercenaries are guys in a unit, and we're doing missions, and there's things going on and stuff, and we're real guys. And we're not the cream of the crop of the best ace mech warriors who cannot be beaten. And like I said, although I'm not totally bashing Stackpole's theories, it was good. It was an entertaining read. It's just hard for me to identify with it, especially since his...
But apparently his writing was good enough for you to have an opinion on it.
I'll say, as I said, he's a good writer. And I can tell he loves the setting he is writing for.
Right.
But I never got the sense, because ultimately these are books that were meant to supplement Battletech.
Yeah.
And I never got the sense reading this stuff that he loved the game Battletech, which is the reason I was buying these books. Yeah. I was not buying these because these were Michael Stackpole books. I don't give a crap about them, quite frankly. I was buying these books because they were Battletech books that did major developments of the plot, and I never got the sense I was reading the work of a fellow Battletech player.
Right.
Ever. And that is why I would not... I put Stackpole in the kind of the mediocre pile, because he was a fantastic writer who just missed the boat on what he was writing about.
Whereas, on the other hand, Jim Long, I've seen him at cons running Battletech tournaments.
Yeah, Jim Long's a great guy. I actually hung out with Jim Long a couple times back when I was still writing for MechForce North America. He and I hung out on several. He's a great guy. Now, with science fiction gaming books, I think probably the beefs most people would have are pretty straightforward.
It's a lot of technical errors.
Technical errors, or maybe the writing's a little bit too immature. Like, it's just, for example, some of the Thurston books for Battletech, where he had like mechs being popped off in one single shot just to show the difference in technology, which is absurd to the game and things like that. But with science, with our fantasy books, rather, it sounds like there's really two problems that seem to pop up with them. Problem number one is they get overly caught in the cliches. You have the great, big, powerful Amazon warrior chick who absolutely no one can get close to and who's effectively asexual, and you've got the unlikely hero, and on and on and on.
Well, it's like Don said, these are written to a certain demographic.
Well, that was point number two, is that these are typically written down to a less mature age group. Forget the cliche thing, because I think why the cliche pops up is pretty straightforward. Tolkien wrote one book, and pretty much everyone's just written sequels.
Yeah.
But let's talk for a second. I'm going to get some email on that one. But let's talk for a second about Why do they write these down in Asia instead of up? Especially given the fact that the most loyal audience to these games has pretty consistently been your 20-somethings, not your 15-year-olds. It's your 20-somethings. Mm-hmm. Why do you think they write these down in Asia?
It could be the fact that, you know, these authors are just writing them a stopgap work between, you know, jobs. It could be just that.
So you're saying, like, a lot of this is hack work, you think?
It could be that. And I think part of it could be just they are gearing it towards a younger audience. Just they're trying to snag people in early. Mm-hmm. Just simplistic plots and simplistic... I'm probably going to get a lot of crap for this, too.
Well, you don't have a Fear the Boot email address.
I don't read a lot of it. What I have read really gives me the sense that either... They weren't putting a whole lot of work into it. They worked with the what was essentially, you know, the setting and the information from that setting, but they didn't put a lot of heart into it.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, and the listeners have to realize, too, is that we're not talking about role-playing game novels as a whole are all bad and hack work. Especially when you look at the D&D stuff, there's just such a huge volume of stuff out there.
Right.
You can't tell me all of that's gold. Because it's not, and I've read some of it, and it is not gold.
Let's talk about one of the real gems out there, conceptually, not a specific book. Mm-hmm. I've seen this definitely in art, and I have not yet read a book that really struck me this way, but I also, as I said before, mostly just read Battletech books. And I'm sure this is probably a lot more prevalent in fantasy than sci-fi. The book where this is their gaming group, or this is the even maybe a game they ran that's being transposed into a book. Now, I've seen it in art. There's definitely a few pictures. Yeah. I'm holding the Shadowrun 2nd Edition book
right here. I've actually read authors who actually done that successfully. I think it's Lois Bugold. She writes the novels for Sikorkian or whatever it is series. They're really, really good books. It's all science fiction and stuff, but she started, I think, out as a gamer, but I think she was actually writing games that they had done.
I think it could work and it could be helpful, because gaming is, if you do a game particularly similar to ours in style, gaming is storytelling. So when you get out there, you are creating a story, you're bouncing it off people, seeing what works, what doesn't work, and one of the nice things is they are giving back to you characters that are all radically different. Because if I sat down and wrote 100 characters, because I am me, you'd eventually start to see patterns and consistencies between these characters, that these are all some version of me. But you get four people making characters for you, you have characters that are all definitely not you and have very different perspectives on it. So I think it could be used kind of as a launch pad for good prose. I think there's got to be some kind of a development or maturity there, because games fundamentally are all kind of a little bit slapstick, and you can tell. And I think that right there says something. Like, as I started to say a little bit earlier, I've got the second edition Shadowrun book sitting in my lap, and there's one or two pictures in there where you look at it, you know this is a portrait of the guy's gaming group.
Yeah.
You can tell just by looking at it, this was the guy's gaming
group.
All
the other pictures are like hot chicks, strong guys, monsters, and then there's a portrait of
a guy with a prepubescent mustache.
Yeah, and he's kind of dopey, and it's them in Shadowrun costumes. I don't know. Would you do that if you could publish a role-playing game book?
You know, I think here's the line. I would not. I think here's the line. That on the one hand, you get people who try and transpose their games or gaming groups into novels, art, whatever, and it doesn't work. Now, I think on the flip side, you could use your games as a launch pad or a testing point for that kind of prose or art. And I think that would work, because for the reasons I gave earlier, that you're developing the story, bouncing off people, getting their perspectives on it. But ultimately, you have to mature it beyond that and grow it beyond that into a whole new form of art.
Right, right.
I personally could never do that, just because I like having complete control over the characters. It's like, why would I want, you know, these other people
messing things up
in my story.
But talking about, we just talked about characters here, this segues really well into our next topic. Chad, you wanted to kick around playing non-humanoids.
Oh, yeah.
And to be clear, when we say, we didn't want to say non-humans, because we're not talking about dwarves and elves. Because, I mean, let's be honest here for a second, that, I mean, dwarves are just short Scottish people, and elves are just tall, effeminate people, and we're talking about creatures and things that are radically non-human.
Playing a dragon.
So why don't you introduce this topic a little bit?
I've always had a problem with people playing things that they can't identify. We talked several episodes ago about males playing females and females playing males. The problem is that they just come off as stereotypes. You're either going to play this absolutely vampy, femme fatale ridiculousness, or you're going to play a man in a woman's body.
Why do you think people do it? I mean, if I'm sitting here, we're playing D&D, mm-hmm. and I decide I've just got to play a water elemental, or we're playing a sci-fi game, and I've just got to play this creeping, multi-legged, crystalline thing.
Just to be different.
You know, I got to agree with you that I think for most, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I've had whole games like that where...
If you factor out the power gamer of saying, well, yeah, I want to play a hill powerful, giant because right. he's got a 38 strength.
Right, let's assume it's not a power thing.
Yeah.
I agree with you, just because I've had whole games where I've had to put down my foot and say, look, this is a gaming party, not a circus freak show.
Right.
Because everyone has got to be something just off the wall just because they want to be unique.
Yeah.
And one of the things I always come back to is, look, you don't need to go this route. Because think of it this way, and I said this in a previous podcast, there's six of us, five of us, four of us sitting around this table. All of us is unique and memorable.
Mm-hmm.
None of us is a water elemental or a multi-legged creeping alien. Or it's, you know, go deeper, not yeah. wider. Or I guess yeah. deeper, not weirder.
Well, it's also people... I don't want to say people are unimaginative, because that's not it at all. It's a matter of... I think that it's a shortcut to coming up with an interesting character. Instead of interesting about who you are, you're interesting in what you
yeah,
are.
He's interesting because he has 27 arms. Not,
yeah.
Not because
or,
he's...
you know, like maybe in my case when I was playing my sock puppet... you feel more comfortable not being a human because that way yeah. you can like, you know, say things you wouldn't otherwise say. It's like, you don't feel like that character's actually could possibly be you.
Develop mm-hmm. that for a second. Cause that's an you interesting know, idea. I'll keep talking
yeah, I mean,
about that.
Just say, you know, this is this weird creature. You know, it's a personification that you put on. It has basically free reign.
Yeah,
you
more can, freeing effect.
You can say things you wouldn't otherwise say.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of talking about like the type of person where there's a lot of things they want to say. They drink a beer and completely loosen up.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, it's not the alcohol.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They just came up with an excuse. Are you saying the character's kind of like that?
Yeah, exactly. It's like suddenly you can be a character because mm-hmm. it's like you're no longer confined by being a human. It's
so
like,
you can break all the social mores.
Yeah, it's like you're suddenly, you can say, hey, I think he's a bleep, bleep, yeah. bleep.
They do that
because,
on...
Just because, you know... You don't. You can. It's like you can play. Be racist or whatever.
Right. I never thought about it from that.
They
angle.
Do that on morning radio shows, not NPR, but like the Imus in the Morning House.
Right.
Imus in the Morning, and I don't really listen to them, but I understand that. Like they have a character that isn't anybody in the studio, but it's just a character, and he says really racist things. Well, the show isn't saying racist things. This character is saying racist things, so the show can't get in trouble.
Or that you know, they just do obnoxious or silly things that you know mm-hmm. the person's trying to be an upstanding character wouldn't normally do.
This kind of gets into a little bit into the is gaming an outlet for antisocial behavior, which we still have yet to do our whole podcast yeah. on that. So I'm not going to develop that here. I had never thought of it that way before. That mm-hmm. people play unusual things as a way of kind of a release.
Mm-hmm. So do you think you let people more play unusual
well,
things?
Well, my
in your
take
games?
On unusual characters has always been this. I will not let anyone play anything for the novelty factor.
Right.
Because simply because the novelty factor wears off after one or two games, and what you're left with, once the plot gets deep and the interactions gets deep, is you're left with nothing.
Yeah,
you have 27 arms. That's
you
all.
You have five guys sitting in a room trying to figure out who kidnapped the king and the water elemental.
Yeah, it's like, I'm a water elemental. Yeah, yeah, we got that memo. Can we get back to work?
Can you do something, please?
I also will not let people play anything unusual for power. Because I think it's just a really, for my games in particular, it's a bad attitude coming into it. That if you're just, you want to play the hill giant just because he has a 35 strength, and I don't care what reason you're giving me, if I know you well enough, I'm getting the sense what's really at work here is you yeah. want the 35 strength. How this fits into this great character idea you've had, quite frankly, just bluff.
Which is why we don't allow orcs or monks in our D&D
yeah,
games.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
I won't allow that either. But having said all these things, if you come to me and say, I want to play something really unusual, because I genuinely have this neat character idea for it. Mm-hmm. And you pitch it to me, it's like, wow, that's really deep, that's really interesting, I'll allow it. The only
come
thing,
up with a good character first,
exactly.
then be the water
if
elemental.
If you come up with a good character who just so happens to be a gnoll or a water element or a hill giant, I'm willing to talk to you. But if you start with, I want to play a hill giant, well, what's he like? Well, you know, deep and all. Oh, really? You don't say.
He's a well giant.
He's a deep well giant.
But, you know, absolutely, no. I would. The other thing I would not allow is I will not allow a freak show. Right. I will not allow the entire party to play things that are so out there.
You've got an Ant-Man, you've got a water elemental, you've got the hill giant, you've got the...
Because the fact is, we...
Dwarf with Tourette's.
That's cool.
I think so.
I'd allow that. But, you know, people, they understand their characters based on a baseline of our everyday experience. That this guy is strong. Well, he is strong compared to the average human being you run into out on the streets, you know, walking down to the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think if you allow a party of freaks, you pretty quickly lose that baseline and the party becomes senseless. No one has anything to measure their character against anymore and just degrades into craziness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it happens with everybody, but every time I've allowed it, that's how it ends.
Yeah.
Well, what if the game's about your party being a bunch of freaks?
I can't, you know, I guess then you do it, but I guess I would ask is, I'd need a for instance there. What kind of plot or setting?
Well, I mean, honestly, what is playing a superhero game about?
Yeah, I was just going to say, what if you play a superhero game and everybody's a mutant? And we're not talking Superman and Batman, we're talking they're mutants. You know, weirdos.
I mean,
and
I
that's
guess,
the point.
I guess the difference there, I would say, is...
Or you
is
play Teenage least, Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Well, I guess, okay, and I guess we could go with, like, Justifiers, which was an old independent game we played where you were
human
hybrid.
Humans with animal heads.
No, because you could be actually fully animal with a human intelligence. You could, you know,
all the pictures just, they have humans with animal heads.
But you could play the other extreme where you're, like, a dog that talked.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the difference there, maybe, and I haven't thought about this, but the difference there, I'd say, is probably that... You're still the same thing as everyone else. So, you know, within Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you may all be human-animal hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're playing an X-Men game, you may all be mutants. But that's just it. It's everyone in the party's a mutant. And a lot of people around you are mutants.
Right.
It's not like this one guy's a mutant, this one guy's a robot, this one guy's a three-headed alien, this one guy's a water elemental.
And then we're playing D&D.
Sounds like X-Men to me.
Well, I guess maybe, but they all had common human experiences and bigotry and things like that they were dealing with. But I guess, I mean, you do have a valid point, though, because maybe, personally, that's why I've kind of shied away from running those games. I've had people ask me, you know, would I run a freak show game? And I've really shied away from doing that
reason. We should try it as an experiment. Is the next game we run is we try and do a freak show game.
Well, actually, the next game I'm thinking about running is a game I wrote, and actually, the last time we played it,
and what's the real name of the game? Because we all call it Danverse, and that's not the real
name. The real name of the game is Epoch of Rhysos.
Epoch of Rhysos.
The last time I ran it, only one person in the party played a human.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the way I wrote this thing. This is not a sci-fi universe where you have funny noses and funny ears. I mean, these are radically different beings. And it actually worked out really well, but I think part of what led into that working out so well was two things. Number one, there was a huge amount of tutoring on the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I did not just let them roll them up and hand me a background. I sat down and explained to them, this is what it has to be like. And you've got some freedom to work in that, but it's got to be like this. And secondly, it's got to be deep.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I did was I made sure that they could actually relate to what they were playing. That this race kind of had tendencies that were similar to the way they thought or the way they behaved anyway. The third thing that I think helped was this is a game that we'd been playing a bunch, and so they were pretty familiar with the races they wanted to play. So it worked out for a couple reasons, but that's one of the few times I've ever allowed it. And of the times I've allowed it, it's probably the only time I've seen it work out well. Let's see if we can at least hack another topic or two here out of the way. This one's going to be a little bit more advice-oriented. I think our last one was kind of advice-oriented, but this is more of our...
Except we really didn't give any advice.
Yeah, don't... Well, okay, here's my... Well, let's turn into some advice. And I'd say number one... If you're not sure, don't do it.
Right.
Simply put, it has so much potential to go wrong for so many reasons. Your party's going to be too weird. They're not going to relate to the plot.
They're not going to relate to each other.
Yeah, they're going to hide. They're going to skip doing depth by instead doing novelty. You have no idea how some of their abilities and powers are going to play out in the game. If you are unsure at all, do not do it.
Yeah. On the other hand, if the campaign lends itself to sort of weirdness, like TNMT or... a mutant game or something like that.
Let's offer some advice, though. Let's say, okay, so you are going to do it. What's some good advice? I'd say thing number one, let's start with the numbers. Be absolutely sure what you are giving them is not going to balance the game.
Actually, I would say even before that, more important than balancing the numbers, is your character interesting? Not, he's a water elemental, so that's pretty interesting.
I guess
it's the chicken
and the egg thing, because quite frankly, if you have an interesting character with imbalancing powers... or a balanced character is uninteresting, you're equally screwed.
Right.
So I'd say it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, but thing number one. Maybe not the first thing, but
just to enumerate it, yeah.
Number A, letter A on the list, is make sure these stats aren't going to break your game. If you've got something, somebody's playing Water Elemental, you've got to think about the fact that he's immune to this, can slide through that. B is make sure this is an interesting character that is being played out on a novel template. Yeah. This is not a novel template where a character may or may not eventually pop up.
You also have to make sure it's not going to screw over your game in that everybody is playing, we'll just for sake of argument say humans. Everybody's playing humans. The king's been kidnapped. There's all this political intrigue. One of the players is going to be named king. His uncle's out to kill him. And it's all taking place in the castle. And one of the guys is playing a well giant. He's playing this really deep guy who's 20 feet tall.
We're going to put up a monstrous manual entry on our site for the well giant.
The well giant. He's deep but big. And he can't fit in to the conference room where all the role-playing's going on.
But he can philosophize
for hours.
Oh,
he's so deep.
Yeah, I'd say similarly to that, I'd look at the social implications of it. For example, if you're playing D&D, and maybe someone really does come up with this brilliant, beautiful concept for a Noel character, which is actually I wanted to play for a while, but I just tend to GM more than I game, or play, rather. What's the social implication of that? Meaning, if this guy can't enter towns. Everyone hates him because he's a freaking gnoll. They eat people.
Right. Oh, but he's the good gnoll.
Yeah, exactly.
No, they still burn him.
The angry riots. You don't know.
Yeah.
And so you have to look at the social implications. Where can this thing, even forgetting the size physics, even if it's a small thing, where can he go? I mean, if you have this big RP scene where you're supposed to be talking to the town smith about how he lost his wife and how that's, you know, kind of broken up his life, how deep of a conversation is a water elemental going to have about that?
Yeah.
So you've got to think about kind of a you versus the environment sort of social implication. I would also throw out, go ahead.
Well, you know, I was also going to say too, it doesn't even have to be a weird character to get that in the sense of, oh, water elementals and all that. Even character classes. We've had problems in the past where we've played D&D and somebody's playing a knight, somebody's playing a religious cleric, somebody's playing a scholarly mage, somebody is playing treasure-hunting rogue trying to steal something for the castle, and somebody's playing a druid. Well, guess who's not with the party in the town?
Right.
They're out in the freaking woods playing with wolves.
And this is going to get even worse if they were playing a nymph or a dryad or something like that, or a little tree spirit.
You can at least, at the worst, send the town guard out, put them in chains, and haul their butt into town for some invented reason.
He warps wood.
Yeah, and he...
all day long.
Great, you're playing a dryad, so now the town guards have to go out there with shovels and dig his butt up and then plant him in town. Great.
That's actually what I was going to talk about next, was the group dynamics. How do these things play out, meaning that if you've got everyone who's working so hard to develop this freak show character, does the character template, does the character intentions, and does the character personality play out well in a group? Like you said, they're all in the town, and the dryad won't come into the town.
Yeah.
Or you get something where this person's a werewolf, this person's a vampire, and they hate each other, and they won't. All they do is try to kill each other and bicker and squabble and whatnot. So you got to think about that aspect as well. So I'd say if you can get past those things, if you can find a deep concept, a balanced concept, and one that will work well in your party, go for it. But I would say do your homework. I mean, if you are not grilling this player inside and out and reviewing their numbers and reviewing their background, their soft information with a fine-tooth comb, you've got disaster on your hands. So I'd be really careful about doing something like this. I mean, my basic default answer when we start a game is no freak show stuff. If someone says, you know what, Dan, I just really would love to play three-headed snake person with wings, I'd be like, all right, sell me.
Yeah.
Convince me this is going to work.
Well, I really like him.
Yeah. I read this book, or I had this dream with this really cool three-headed. Okay, right. Okay, so what you're telling me is you're playing a human fighter.
Right. You know, and actually a piece of advice for people who want to play these things, because I think we've been giving GM advice. You create your water elemental, and he's all cool, and he's got a good background. But when you play him, make sure you play a water elemental. Don't play a human wearing a water elemental costume.
Let me give one backup piece of advice, and I really want to develop what you just said, is when you are making these things, just as we said to the GMs, don't let a player play something for the cool factor. Players don't want to play something for the cool factor. Yeah. Just because you read a book where this was really cool, or you just got back from seeing this or that movie, or you had a dream with this weird thing in it, doesn't mean it's a good character idea.
But isn't that where 90% of the character ideas come from in the first place?
Yeah, sadly. Yes. Why do you think 90% of the character concepts don't work? You got to avoid that stuff, because just as that depth fades away, or becomes lack of depth becomes evident very quickly, this is going to be the neatest character ever, because, oh, I got 27 arms and I'm made of water and this and the other. And by game two, you're like, I got 27 arms and I'm made of water and that's all I got going.
What do you do? Right. I scintillate.
I burble.
I shiver.
Clap 13 and a half times. All right, but let's talk about, you had something really good, which is if you're going to do it right.
Do it right.
Realize that despite the need for depth and all, your water elemental is a water elemental and it's not a water person. Do you have any advice for getting that down?
Well, one thing I guess I'd say is research, although we'll use our water elemental,
There's nothing to read.
Yeah, what do you do?
I'd agree with you. Start by researching.
Yeah. You know, if we're talking about like D&D or any game, generally speaking, when you want to play something weird, it's a matter of you want to play something out of their monster manual or something completely invented.
Right.
If you completely invent it, make sure you write out something beyond that's just your character. Write out a couple of things, or at least think about what is the race, where did this thing come from?
Why is it hanging out with humans, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, were you like the slave to this magician for like 100 years and suddenly you're free?
Even beyond that, like, where's their race from?
Yeah.
What religions do their race worship? Why do they worship that? What are their personalities like?
Mm-hmm.
Do they, in water elemental land, do they have taverns?
You know, something you could also go do with that is you could also kind of add things onto the end of it. For example, a lot of stuff in D&D is actually based on mythology. I'm not talking Tolkien now. I'm talking like Norse mythology and things like that.
Greek mythos.
Yeah. You can always go beyond that, saying, okay, well, I'm going to play a dryad, and I want to follow, say, Forgotten Realms, Myleiki. Mm-hmm. Well, Myleiki is an actual, like, Scandinavian goddess or something like that.
Right.
So if there's not enough in the D&D book to really give you a sense of what a dryad follower of Myleiki would be like, hit your mythology books first, look up things on dryads. When you're done with that, head over to, I think it's Scandinavian, but look up Myleiki and learn some more things about that belief system.
Wikipedia is your friend in this case.
Or Encyclopedia Britannica, the library, whatever works for you, and develop it a little more there. I think the written material is a great place to start. And, you know, I think selecting something you can relate to is a good beginning. If you find something you can make sense of, for example, in the game that I ran where I allowed the freak show, I had a guy who's gaming who is really into Chinese culture and Chinese history, Romance of the Three Kingdoms, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He picked up one of my races, kind of read through it, and said, you know, these guys, for this reason, and this reason, remind me a lot of these certain kinds of people from China from a certain time period.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, he was able to fill in blanks and, in a sense, play this alien race in a way that was more vivid than I had intentionally imagined them, way better than I had written them, probably, because he could relate to it. But it goes back to it. He started with the research. He asked me, what are they like? He went on to add some information to that, and it worked out really well.
Yeah. Don, what do you think? Do you think that people can play weird characters?
Oh, yeah. I think they can do it. I'd be wary.
Mm-hmm.
Just depends on how much both the GM and the player want to put into it.
Right.
How much energy you are actually willing to expend to make this character work.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that what we call freak show characters require, if you want to play them well and the GM wants to let them, it's going to require a little bit more work than playing a human fighter.
I'd say it's take a lot more work.
Yeah.
Because you have to do the same level of background, personality, whatever, but you have to add on to the front end of that a whole lot of coaching and research, and on the back end of that, a whole lot of review. Say, look, how did this turn out, and is this going to work in the party?
Well,
so,
and you know what? If a player comes up to me and was willing to put that kind of time into their character, I'm going to give them the green light. Maybe
some people
I might
have
not even
a lot more fun with the creative process in that aspect.
Right.
You know,
I might even let a couple of things slide that I may not agree with, that may not be quite kosher with the game, if they're willing to put that amount of work into them. Because if they're putting that amount of work into them, then great. You know, that means they're really going to play them and they're really going to get into them.
Right.
So I'm all about that.
Well, you know, we had some other topics here on the hit list, but quite frankly, we've hit about the 1 hour mark here on
these. 1 hour already?
I know. So we're going to go ahead and hold those off for episode 14. Mm-hmm. So thank you guys for tuning in, and I guess we made it through episode 13 okay. As I said, these are definitely against
us. No explosion. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So we will catch you guys next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.